And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Hello! Today is Wednesday, April 6th. Thursday, April 6th. We are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Gino. I'm here with Darren and Kevin. You can listen to us any way you get your podcast. Please like and subscribe. Follow us on Facebook. Talk to us. We want to talk to you. Baseball started. NHL and NBA playoffs are almost here. The Masters, that's right, a tradition like no other, started today. Little weird conditions, we'll talk about that. But let's start it off with college basketball. They crowned the champion Monday night. UConn Huskies beat San Diego State Aztecs 76-59 to take home their fifth championship. Listen, they were just too much for San Diego State when it came down to it. San Diego State cut it down to five in the second half. And then Hawkins hit a big three. They went on a little mini run. They scored six. It was a nine-point run in total. They took the lead to 14. They never looked back at that point. The big fact about UConn with this was they won all six games by 13 points or more. They basically, for the most part, blew out the field when it came down to it. And we are off and running. The season is over. Darren?
UConn was the best team in the tourney after the first half of game one against Iona. Jordan Hawkins is simply an amazing player. I don't even know what else to say. Sonogo's a beast, and they get everybody chips in, and Jackson, and all these guys are really good players. Caliban, even they have a backup 7'3" center that nobody can touch. I mean, nobody can give the riches. This is like Ralph Dalton being Patrick Ewing's backup center for 4 years. I mean, having a kid like that that's just coming off the bench, giving a few minutes here and there. But Jordan Hawkins is the reason why this team was able to go, in my opinion. Every time the game got a little close, he would hit a big shot, a lot of times contested. The story with him was his father wanted to name him Kobe. His mother said no, so they went to Jordan. You know, I mean, still they wanted to keep the lineage of basketball going with this kid. The one thing I came to realize is I really dislike UConn. I didn't think I did, but I don't know. There's something about UConn I just don't enjoy, and I haven't enjoyed for a few years. And, you know, maybe because they haven't been on top, it really didn't affect me. But I was really hard against them.
Is it Hurley?
Anything with the Hurley family bothers me a little bit. And I don't know. I just, I should like him. They're a Northeast team. They're a Big East team. And for some strange reason, I can't get past it. But San Diego State did everything they could, I thought. Problem with them, Bradley, who's their best player all year long, was pretty well awful the entire tournament. And when you couldn't get the stuff from your best player, what can you do? I mean, Mensa and Lede battled the best they could down low. Trammell wasn't hitting his shots. Neither was Butler, really. But they fought and they scrapped a little bit. But Bradley's the guy he's the 50th senior transfer guy that's supposed to give you the 18 to 20, and he's giving you 6 or 8. And that's the difference for this team. The fact that they made it as far as they did without their best player pretty much the whole tournament, pretty impressive to them. The other thing is when you look at the Elite Eight teams, a lot of these teams are going to be battling just to get back into the tournament next year. There's a lot of, depending on transfers, the college basketball landscape is so different now that, you know, unless you get the quality transfers, you don't have a lot of guys coming back. And, it's going to be interesting for San Diego State. It's going to be interesting for UConn to an extent. A lot of guys going pro. A lot of guys transfer out, you know, it's a lot of guys graduate. So great tournament overall, probably the most, you think about it last year, you had Kansas, you had Villanova, you had Duke and North Carolina. If you can get more blue blood, I don't know how you do it. You replace Villanova with Kentucky, I mean, or UCLA. It's the only way you get more blue blood. This year, no bloods. Now Connecticut has made themselves a blue blood, 5 titles, and really mostly recently. So, yeah. I mean, they tie Indiana. And who was it? Indiana and Duke, I think, with the 5 titles now for third, behind UCLA leading the way, obviously, all the way through. So, you know, hats off to UConn. I really don't like you, but you know what? You were the best team. You deserve to win. Kev?
Yeah, you saw the line I think I had written down here in my notes. I said, underwhelming end to a terrific tournament.
Very well and played.
It really was. Yeah. You know, we got to the Final Four. The first game of the Final Four, San Diego State and FAU, was a terrific ending. FAU had the lead. They were led by 14 with about 14 left. They proceeded to go 5 for 14, 6 turnovers. And Lamont Butler hit the game winner at the buzzer for San Diego State. That's what March Madness is. Game-winning buzzer beaters. Especially in the Final Four. You get to the last championship game and you're thinking, all right. And then UConn played Miami. And it was almost identical to the UConn-San Diego State game. They had a 12 or 13 point lead at halftime in both games. Extended it out. They had a 20-point lead on Miami. They were up by 15 over San Diego State. The opponents made a little bit of a run. Miami got it to 8. San Diego State got it to 5. UConn responds, extends the lead back to double digits, and coasts to victories. And unfortunately, you know, Monday night, I'm sure you guys were in the same boat as I was. We were recording our baseball preview. We were watching the game, not really closely, but we were watching the score. And by the time we turned the game on in the second half, really started paying attention. It wasn't much of a game. Even when San Diego State cut, even when they cut it to 5, I didn't think that they were going to come all the way back.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that you was noticeable was you see some of these teams go on a run and they whip off 9 points, 10 points. It's 2 or 3 straight possessions, and San Diego State to get back into this game, it's this slow burn. It's all right. We're down 12. Okay, we're down 10. We're down 9. Up. We're down 11, and we're down 8. Oh, we're down, and they. San Diego State, because of the foul trouble they were in, because of the style they play, just was never able to have a run where they whipped off 9-10 straight points to go on a 10-2 run and make up the 8 points, whereas UConn and some of these other teams can. Kev?
Their 10-2 run takes 5 minutes of playing time.
That's it.
It's not the minute and a half 10-2 run where you've shocked the other team. It's very – like you said, slow, methodical, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I guess we're in a game now.
It was weird. I mean, because you sit there and you go through all the teams. You go through this whole squad. First of all, this is the first team since Nova did it that won all their games by double digits. Doesn't happen very often. Usually the games aren't really this close. We're talking, and Kev actually asked a question as we end our podcast. I think we were off the air at that point. You're like, how are they calling it? And at the half, there were a grand total of 13 fouls called. So I'm like, they're letting them play. And all of a sudden, I put it on in the second half, and San Diego State had 9 fouls about 9 minutes in. And I was like, guess they stopped letting them play. Now, it was hard to really follow it as much. I went with the first half stats, but they must have either they were hacking like crazy or they really tightened it up. And then it just looked like once they were in the double bonus for the last 10 minutes of the game, there was no chance of coming back. Jake?
Mention, and you got to mention, Darren, and you could tell it because you saw it. You got to mention the interview that they did with Hurley at halftime where they asked him, and he basically blatantly said, we should be up by 20 at this point.
Yeah, he felt that they should have been dominating. And the thing was is that they did jump out. San Diego State would always – just find a way just to – they're a really hard-fought defensive team, and they need the game to be called very loosely in order for them to be effective with their style because they just don't have the same talent. I mean, as much as I talk about Matt Bradley being a disappointment, the thing is he's kind of like – against a UConn team, he's undersized. And against a lot of the good teams in this tournament, he's kind of undersized. In the Mountain West, he can get his shots off. But you saw that he struggled getting the shots off here, and it was – and it was pretty blatant that they were not really he cannot find a way to win his matchup. And when your best player can't win his matchup and you're relying on all your secondary players, that's just kind of what happens. But this tournament shouldn't be marred by the fact that we had 2 bad games to end it, because Florida Atlantic was an unbelievable story. It really was.
They were.
Oh, my God. And Fairleigh Dickinson was an unbelievable story. I mean, these were things – I mean, I know that we've seen a 16 beat a 1 before. Fairly Dickinson was a joke 16. They shouldn't. They didn't even win their tournament. They lost in the final. We made fun of them getting in. We're like, why does Merrimack even get to play in their conference tournament? Then they come out and they beat 7 foot four Zach Edey in Purdue. You know, Marquise Noel was the most fun player in the tournament. He was 5'8", just throwing the ball around, but he was a blast. And again, as a guy that follows Kansas State, I watched him play at least 20 games a year in the last 2 years, and it's fun to see other people get to say, wow, this kid's pretty good. And he wasn't hitting those deep shots like he normally does, and he was still great. So there was a lot of fun things about this. What unfortunately happens, though, when we have the upsets and we have the teams that are the four and the five seeds, you don't get to see that team that's big and strong enough to stand up to UConn at the end. Miami had to do it with mirrors. San Diego State has to do it with mirrors. Florida Atlantic has to do it with mirrors a little bit. Not saying these teams are bad, but you don't get that one seed that's like, no, you're not running Zach Edey off the boards. No, you're not. You're not going to bully UCLA because they're just going to play you down dirty and nasty all the way through and slow the tempo down. That's where you lose out with the upsets. But the upsets are what makes the madness madness. So it's just kind of you're in a catch 22. You know, you want to see great games at the end, but at the same time, we saw great games throughout.
I gotta wait a whole year to start yelling madness and madness again.
I mean, you mentioned the seed, and you know, UConn was a four seed, and you think they're playing Miami, a five, San Diego State, I think, was a five. So you think these would be evenly matched teams. And I wonder if the net ratings, which I know you're not a fan of, but they had UConn top 10 going into the tournament.
UConn was the last undefeated team in the country. Remember that? In New Mexico were the last two teams. UConn had a slump in the middle of the year. They started out like gangbusters, had a little bit of a mini slump, and they ended really strong.
They only lost Big East games.
Yeah, they did not lose
a game out of the conference. And you wonder if, you know, in hindsight, you know, don't want to say because they won, but looking how dominant they were they a little bit underseeded as a four?
Well, I think they were. G.
Not only that, but my. You know, I want to look at it, and I haven't had a chance yet, is how the hell did they lose the Big East Conference tournament? They get into the NCAA
tournament.
That's
a good team, G.
They got into the NCAA tournament. They went through a six-game run where they blew everybody out by 13 points or more. You know, for me, I want to go back now and take a look and see where the hell they lost because, you know, I know Marquette's good, Darren, but, you know, they really ripped through these teams, so...
I'm just going to ask you a question, though. Do you think, and it's going to be a hypothetical, we can't really answer it, but do you think they would be able to blow out Creighton if Creighton would have gotten by San Diego State the way they blew out San Diego State?
I think
Creighton's offense would have kept that game a little bit more competitive, just my take.
I think it would have been a much closer game, but the run that Connecticut was on in this tournament, I can't imagine that they wouldn't have won that game by 10 against Creighton. I can't. Yeah, and I know Creighton much better offensively, Darren.
My only point about the whole tournament and the seedings, right? Connecticut wasn't picked by a lot of people to go very far. And here's the reason. They were in a bracket with Kansas, UCLA, and Gonzaga. Had they been the four where Tennessee was the four, or going up against the Purdue, you would have seen a lot of people picking them to go further. It was because they were in the bracket with the big boys. You had the defending champ. You got the biggest name out there in Gonzaga that everybody's expecting to make a run, and Timmy's Timmy, and you have UCLA, who's just a nasty, hard team. So when you take out the fact that they were in the wrong bracket, I think even as a four seed, people would have picked them in a couple of the other brackets, maybe not against Alabama, because I think everybody had Alabama as, like, you know, great. But I think people would have picked them against Houston, and I think people would have picked them against Purdue.
I think
that we would have seen a lot more people on the Connecticut bandwagon. They just got the wrong four. They just put them in the wrong bracket for people to see it because we all knew they were good going in.
Listen, it's a good point. I'll give you that. It's a very, very good point. So, all right. So the men's is over. I have another year before I can start saying madness and madness. Kev, you want to touch on the women's finals?
Yeah.
Yes, he does.
Supposed to the men, the women's games were actually, the two Final Four games were terrific. LSU beat Virginia Tech 79-72. It was a game of two runs. LSU had a 9-point lead in the second half. Va Tech went on a 25-5 run covering the second and third quarters, had a 59-50 lead after the third, and they started off the fourth quarter, LSU on a 22-3 run. They led by 10 with 3 minutes left and coasted. That set up the game that anybody who's a women's college basketball fan was waiting for, was Iowa and South Carolina. And the biggest key to that game, Iowa played with the lead the whole way. They got out 8-2, which I think was so big for them. It gave them the confidence to say, "Oh, hey, we can play them." South Carolina finally battled back in the second half. Three separate times, Carolina took a 1-point lead. Three times, Iowa battled back or answered right back and retook the lead. After the third quarter, Iowa was up by 4. Fourth quarter, South Carolina scores the first 5. And if you're a Gamecock fan, you're probably thinking, all right, we've got the 1-point lead. It's the fourth quarter. Time for us to take over.
Like you are, Kev.
Caitlin Clark, 3-pointer. And they never trailed again. Clark finished the game 41-8-6. Fourth quarter, she had 16 of the 18 Iowa points. The only other bucket she assisted on. So she had a phenomenal game. The fouls in that game, I don't understand what the referees were looking at. It's not the reason why South Carolina lost. Don't get me wrong.
The women's officiating makes the men's officiating look great. In almost every game you see.
I was playing from the outside. South Carolina was pounding it in. And yet the foul shots were even until late in the game when South Carolina had a foul Iowa. It was just awful. And then we go to the finals, and the officiating got worse. They've got technical designs, Caitlin Clark. Kim Mulkey is able to run on the court. She's able to touch officials and not get even a warning. That game, LSU took control early. Foul trouble on both teams. Jasmine Carson off the bench with 21 in the first half. And she ended the half on a turnaround, off-balance, bank 3, which just showed it was LSU's game.
Do you think she called glass, Kev?
I would like to see if she called glass.
The bank was open.
Then Iowa started to get close. Cut it down to 9, and on a play where Zanano, who's Iowa's center, picked up her 4th on the dead ball, Clark sort of just batted the ball away, and she gets called for a T, which is her 4th foul. Game was over at that point. I mean, there's no need for that T right there. It was awful. So then came the controversy at the end. Angel Reese, who's named most outstanding player. She does the John Cena, you can't see me hand gesture. She's pointing at her ring finger showing we're going to be the champions and all. And everything comes down on Angel Reese. She's a thug. She's this. She's ghetto. She's disrespectful. Did anybody not see the week before when Caitlin Clark's doing the same gesture in a game against Louisville? Did anybody not see Caitlin Clark when they're playing South Carolina? They were sagging off their guard, Jackson. Clark was like, gave her a wave. Like, I'm not even going to bother guarding her. She's not worth guarding me. Caitlin Clark talks more trash than anybody else.
She's Larry Bird.
And the fact that you criticize one and not the other. And Clark came out after the game. I give her credit. She said, that didn't bother me. I think deep down, she knows that she talks as much trash as anybody. She needs to have a thick skin and take it. And she took it. So LSU went by 17 and wins the women's title. And that was it for the women's. Darren, you had a couple points, I think, or at least 1 point.
Well, a couple. I mean, Dawn Staley, stop. Okay. Everything doesn't have to be about race every single time something goes wrong. You get interviewed, and now all of a sudden the coach is trying to compliment you by saying that basically we have to, you know, you got to play really, really rough to play against this team. And all of a sudden, they're calling us thugs because we're black. Nobody is.
Yeah.
Stop. You cancel. You walk on water. I mean, what have you done? You walk on water. Nobody ever questions you. You cancel the series against BYU for a fake allegation on race. No one ever calls you out on it. Now no one calls you out on this. Enough. Yep. Listen, we don't need race in these games. We don't. You know why? Because nobody cares. We want to watch good basketball. And South Carolina was the best team all year. And yes, it's unfortunate that they lose in the semifinal because they probably were the best team throughout. They just didn't have a great game that night. If they would have played their game, if those two teams play 100 times, South Carolina wins 75 of them, in my opinion. Maybe 80. I'm just being fair. But it just didn't happen that night. And that happens in these tournaments all the time.
Yep.
She just drives me nuts, and I loved her as a player, and I loved her as an Olympian. I thought she was a great point guard, and I thought she did a lot of great things when she was at Virginia, but wow, everything has to be about race. It just drives me crazy. And my second point was simply what yours was. Angel Reese didn't do anything wrong. She basically talked trash back to a player that talked trash a couple of weeks earlier. But the women's tournaments got a little bit more intense than even the men's tournament with the trash talking. You had the Memphis player punching the girl on Louisville, I mean, during the handshake line. I mean, there's no control. Yep. You got Mulkey all over the court and not getting critiqued at all and able to just get away with it like it's funny. How is that funny? How is that entertaining? Listen, your outfits are flamboyant. Great. Who cares? You're a style. Fine. Everybody loves style. Everybody wants people that are colorful. That's great. Get off the freaking court. Nobody wants to see you out there. You're not a player. Your team played great. I was rooting for LSU going into the game, and I just was for some reason. I just, you know, I thought they were the underdog. I thought everybody was on the Caitlin Clark bandwagon. I was like, you know, I'm going to root for LSU. I'm going to root for Angel Reese, who, had, by the way, is now 4-0 against Caitlin Clark. When she was at Maryland, they beat her every time. I didn't realize that. I looked that up. But so she's had her number, even though they don't play the same position. It's not like they go head-to-head. Caitlin Clark still had a monster game in the loss, by the way. Still put up 30. I mean, but it's like, you know, just enough of the race being, enough of the crap. Let's just try to, you know, they it's a nice game. Let's be honest. The defense in these games isn't great. The athletes aren't the same as watching the men as much as they try to make it out like. And everybody's sitting there talking to me about, oh, they shoot better than the men. Well, the ball's an inch smaller. Makes it a little easier to get into the hoop. You know, and the three-point line's a foot shorter. I mean, there are a little bit of advantages. I'm not trying to say that, but it's like saying the college game is better than the pro game. The players in men's college are better than the men's pro. I might enjoy the college game better, but it's not a better brand. You know, it's like, come on. But overall, you know, the women's NCAA was at least had some storylines. It was a little bit gripping. But, you know, players have to just respect each other. And the media has to try not to make everything into a freaking mountain. And social media is really just a pain in the ass. G?
Okay. College basketball over. Let's move on to some Masters. Today started the 87th Masters. It's the first major of the year. Scottie Scheffler is the returning champ. He came in at 5-1 odds. At the moment, we have three players tied at -7 through one round, two players at -5. We have six players at -4. And then we have 33 players at even or better. The course is playing very well right now. The scores are way up right now, probably because of conditions. We'll talk about it a little bit. I will tell you this. The favorites going in, Scheffler was 5-1, McIlroy at 7-1, and Rahm at 9-1. Those were the three right off the bat. I'll give you a couple of odds and stuff when we get to the back end. Kev, tell me about the...
Well, what a leaderboard. It's interesting. You've got some of the live golfers out here. You've got, I think, 18 of them playing in the Masters, including six former champions, Dustin Johnson, Reed, Bubba, Phil, Schwartzel, and Sergio. You've got 14 other former Masters winners playing. And the course today, I think, with the warm weather, the scoring conditions were ideal today. That's going to change very quickly if the weather comes in.
Absolutely.
The ones who play this afternoon who are playing tomorrow morning might have the big advantage. Weather might start to change in the afternoon tomorrow, which affects that grouping. And it's going to be raining all day Saturday. The temperature is dropping more than 30 degrees from what it was today. So now you're looking at cold, wet, rainy, windy. Those 65, 66s you see today, you're not going to see that Saturday. Like I said, going in, you know, you look at, you know, a guy like John Rahm, you expect him to be up there. He opened up double bogey on the first hole today, a four-putt double bogey, finished at 7-under. He recovered very quickly. Brooks Koepka, a four-time major winner, battled injuries in the last couple of years on the PGA, so he disappeared a little bit, joined the LIV Tour. So, of course, nobody ever hears about him anymore. I know he won, I think it was last week, the LIV Tour in Orlando. So for him to go out there and shoot 7-under, he's healthy, still a great player. Victor Hovland, I think I heard that he was a low amateur in 2019 when Tiger won the Masters his last time, so he's had success on the course. So no surprise there. Jason Day, this season, has been third in scoring average. That happens one of my longer shots at 25-1. He's in contention. Cam Young, he's been playing well. He's there at 5-under. Woodland, Scottie Scheffler, defending champ, number one player in the world, is at 4-under. These are the guys that have a chance. Now, if you start looking at some of the weather possibly changing, Jane Lowry sitting there at 4-under, the Irishman. He won the 2019 Open in terrible weather in Royal Portrush. He's a guy that can maybe come back with the weather. Rory, you never count him out in the weather. He's at even par right now. He's still alive, I think. Tommy Fleetwood, he's sitting there at even par also. Another English player. They're used to the weather. You've got JT at -2. You've got Max Homa at -1. Cam Smith at -2. Spieth at -3. Morikawa at -3. So it's a hell of a leaderboard. And going into Friday, if leaderboard can hold up this way with those names, it's going to be a fun weekend to watch.
So hypothetical for you guys. Well, first of all, I'm in this little pool, and the way the pool works is you got to pick four golfers, and to be in contention, all four have to make the cut. You're only allowed to take one guy from column A, one guy from column B, and then the other two guys are from the field. So column A was, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but column A was, you know, Scheffler, Rahm, Thomas, McIlroy, stuff like that. Colin B is like Cantlay, and you know, who's a Spieth and a couple of guys like that. So I have two teams in, and you know, I have one team. One of the guys I like, one of my sleepers, is Cam Young, so I have him on a team. So I have Cam Young with Joaquin Neiman, who's -2 also. Young's -5 with Rahm, was my A guy, who's -7, and Spieth at -3. Now, my other side, I had Scheffler. So I went, I separated Rahm and Scheffler. And my number two guy was Cantlay, who's still hanging around. He's -1 right there, or even somewhere, is one or the other. And, you know, all of a sudden, one of my other two guys was Will Zalatoris, who did before the match starts. So I'm now out. That whole bracket is out no matter what, because he hurt himself in warm-up. Now, there's a whole bunch of debate from the guys in the pool that have Zalatoris. Oh, we should get to pick another player. But unfortunately, you just really can't once they start playing, because you're going to pick someone that's good. But it's just kind of like one of those, you know, those funny coincidences that you can't do anything about. And just kind of found it funny. But I was really impressed. I know Jason Day's been playing better, but I was really impressed with how he came out today. I also thought Shoffley, who had not been playing that great, had a really nice round. I think -4 he ended up out there.
Yep.
And I thought that was pretty impressive for him, because he had not been playing good golf in the last few weeks. So it was nice to see him out there. But when you have the leaderboard like this, it's a lot of fun. Even Freddie's out there at -1. And, yep. And, you know, I mean, Freddie has that Thursday, and then by Friday the back is barking and it's over. But you know what? He gave you a run today. He was -2 after through 16. He had a chance, you know, at that point. Hovland was the leader, but everybody else was around minus two, minus three. Then all of a sudden, the afternoon players, like you pointed out, Kev, seemed to explode. You know, Koepka, Rahm, you know, these guys just shot up. Like you said, double bogey on one, and all of a sudden, the guy finishes minus seven overall. I love the U.S. Open as well, but to me, this is always, it kicks off the golf season. It's just a beautiful course. It's a bucket list. I'd love to get there. I'd love to watch. I'd love to watch a couple rounds, walk the course, be part of it. Just a lot of fun. Looking forward to the weekend. G?
So let me talk a little betting on the Masters. So what I'm going to give you was before everything started today, okay? I don't like to tackle it by trying to get the winner. I like to tackle it by trying to get players that are going to finish in the top 10, because that way you could kind of get bet four or five different guys you like, and you'll get decent odds, and you may hit not on just one, but on multiple bets, right? So a couple that I highlighted, and I'll give you the two favorites right off the bat. So you could have had John Rahm to finish in the top 10 at minus 110. Scheffler was minus 150. And then you had other guys like Dustin Johnson at plus 210, Morikawa plus 210. Cam Young was actually a plus 250 to finish in the top 10, okay? And then you had other guys like Patrick Reed at plus 500, Minwoo Lee plus 500. So you could have basically taken four or five guys, even if you're only betting $5 a bet, and with $25 covered five golfers to finish in the top 10. And that way, if you hit one or two of them, you're going to feel like at least you got something for your money. If you're just picking a winner, only one of, even if you hit it, only one of those bets is going to win, right?
Very true.
The other thing, and I will specifically tell you that DraftKings had this, is you could actually bet a combination of two golfers to finish in the top five, okay? Obviously, now the odds are going a lot higher because you're picking them to finish five, and it's two basically of the five golfers. But you could have had Scottie Scheffler and Jason Day 15-1. You could have had Rahm and Morikawa at 16-1. Just a couple of combinations you could bet on, and it gives you a little chance without just picking a winner at random. Darren, I actually looked up Cam Young. I knew you were on him. Right now, you can get him to finish in the top five at plus 260.
Wow.
top 10 plus 115. And if you really think he's got a shot at winning at the moment, and I know he's tied for fourth at five under, he's plus 1600 to actually win this right now.
Wow.
Just that's a couple a, of
that's
just
a lot. Of
you know, I don't want to get, I won't get deep into some of these, but I mean, there's a lot of things you can bet on. You can bet on end of round leaders and scores and everything. But if you just want to keep it simple, take a couple of golfers, bet them to finish in the top 10, and maybe you hit a couple and you'll actually get ahead with some money. That's just thoughts, guys.
Yeah, just one quick point, just because I skipped it. When I said that I had Zalatoris, the other guy I have is Fitzpatrick, who's also an Englishman that might play well in the weather also. Yep. And so I have three guys that look really good, and then Zalatoris doesn't play. And I'm like, oh, one of my entries is eliminated. So I was crying a little bit.
And Zalatoris,
I skipped the fourth guy. But Fitzpatrick's another guy. He's a little guy, but the English guys are used to playing in this weather.
Yep.
They just are.
And Zalatoris is he seems like he's really close to breaking through and winning the major here.
He missed so close last year. You know, I mean, he's a player. There's so many talented guys. What we want to see now on Sunday is that Rory gets to walk with one of the live guys and see if there's any fisticuffs. That's what we want to see. You know, it's not going to be Rory and Phil, but you would love to see, you know, Rory and Koepka just like arguing or something like that. Because Rory is very passionate about the guy, against the guys that left, more so than a lot of guys. He's very vocal about it anyway. But what do you think about them letting the live guys play, Kev?
I think I'm fine with it. The Masters, they have their criteria for playing, for inviting people. And you know, the Masters is going to do what the Masters wants to do.
No doubt.
And to me, I agree with, you know, PGA Tour keeping them off, but like I said, for something like the Masters and the majors, it's still good to see the best players in the world together.
I mean, that's the thing. The other majors are going to be very different this year. We're not going to see this kind of leaderboard. I mean, when you take guys away, like you mentioned earlier, like Koepka, like DeChambeau, even like Phil, just getting to see him coming in, like Cam Smith, guys that are good, you know, real good. I mean, there's a bunch of others. I just named a few. But, I mean, you know, these are guys you look forward to seeing on a leaderboard. And unfortunately, we're not going to see that after the Masters for the most part. So I've not watched 1 second of LIV, but I've heard that it's kind of fun. It's kind of like us playing with our friends at a shotgun start and kind of going nuts, loud music, then drinking beer and everybody having a good time. I don't know. I haven't watched it. More team sport. I haven't seen it yet.
I watched it for about 10 or 15 minutes Sunday or okay. Saturday. I guess it was Saturday, waiting for the final four, I think. With the shotgun start, you've got guys all over the course, and it's rapid fire. There's action all over the place, which I guess is good for people who have short attention spans, who like the pitch clock in baseball, who like the things, you know, rush, rush, rush. But I still like to know where they are on the course and what holes they've played. And, you know, the Masters, we know, especially the Masters, we know the layout. We know what the back nine looks like. And also you've got a guy out there, you know, if they went by LIV rules, well, this guy's through through 13 holes. Oh, he must be coming up on, you know, it must be in an aim and corner and all that. Oh, no, it's his 13th hole, but he's back on three. It just ruins the flow of the action. Darren?
What I was told was, and I haven't seen it, so you could probably correct me on if I'm wrong, that you see a lot more putting than you see shots from the fairway because it just seems like they're just showing people finish out. So you don't see all the tee shots. You miss some things that you look forward to in golf because they're showing you the final score rather than how they got there. And that is one of those things. I mean, listen, as golfers that like us at our level, 30 handicaps, 25 handicaps, whatever it is, you know, we enjoy seeing the player being fallible. The guy hit it into the woods. The guy hit it into the water. The guy that misses the green like we do. The guy that hits it and it bounces off. And when all you're seeing is putting, you don't really feel like, you're seeing the fallibility of the golfer. That's why the U.S. Open is always so exciting to me because that course is made to just beat the crap out of you. You know, if you finish under par, it's a big deal. You know, just one of those things. Gee.
Did you guys follow that the European Tour, the DP World Tour, that they came out with a ruling where they may actually punish the LIV golfers?
I did not see that.
Yeah, and not let them play. We'll get into it a little bit more in the next weeks because I think it may have a big impact on how the LIV golfers are going to actually play in some of these tours, not the Masters specifically, but in some of these other tours. But all right, let's talk some NHL hockey. We are almost down to the end. This is it. There's like 4 or 5 games. A lot of these teams only have 4 or 5 games left. Kev, NHL?
Yeah. Islanders, big win. Game just ended as we're recording this. They beat Tampa 6-1. Definitely needed. Given the fact that both Florida and Pittsburgh won tonight too. So they will have 3 games left. Right now, Florida and the Islanders are tied. And Pittsburgh's a point back. That's really the only race in the Eastern Conference left. Top 3 in the other 2 divisions are pretty much set. I think we got to see Rangers Devils in the first round. So really the Eastern Conference is only down to the wild card race. And the question is, can the Islanders hang on here? Their schedule is not too bad. Last couple of games, they've got Philly, Washington, and Montreal. You know, do what you're supposed to do. Go out there and beat those teams, make the playoffs. Then we can really have fun this playoff season.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, technically the thing is they're behind the Florida because of wins and regulation. Love to finish ahead of Florida just because nobody wants to play Boston in the first round. The Islanders are one of those teams that's usually pretty good at playing up the competition. I don't think anybody wants to play Boston in the first round.
That's a different level.
That's a death sentence right now. So you don't want to do that. So it's important you get your 6 points. Hope that Florida slips up, loses a point here or there. And you hope that Pittsburgh finds a way to lose. Tonight was one of those matchups where you were hoping that Pittsburgh might fall in a game against Minnesota, and they didn't. Right? So it's like, you know, that was one that you kind of was like, hey, Minnesota could steal this one, and they didn't. So just one of those things. By the way, you know, when you look at it, the West is also very exciting as the Calgary Flames, the team I root for, who has the second most shots on goal in hockey and the third fewest allowed, yet only outscores their opponents by 12 goals because we have no one that can stop the freaking puck. They find a way to lose to the worst team in the West at home and then win the must-win game the next night in Winnipeg to keep themselves at least – they make me have to stay up late is what they're doing because they're not going to – because they don't have the goaltending to win. And even if they get in, they're going to lose 7-1. But it's like now – but I'm glued. Now I'm stuck watching a team that can shoot but doesn't necessarily score and they can't stop anybody. And but that West is really exciting down to three teams also. You got Nashville – who's 3 points behind Calgary and Winnipeg with two games in hand. Winnipeg also has a game in hand on Calgary as well. So it's interesting. Calgary does not have a tough schedule down the stretch, but one of those games is Nashville at home. So they have Nashville, they have San Jose, and I believe, it might be Anaheim. So they don't have really three tough games. Two of those are at home. They got to find a way to win them. If the Flames get 6 points and they don't get into the playoffs, they don't deserve it, but I think if they get the 6 points, they will get in. But I don't trust the goaltending on this team at all. Winnipeg's a better team than we are. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, going into tonight, the Central Division out there, you had Colorado, Dallas, and Minnesota all tied with 98 points.
Yeah, Colorado has, I think, a game in hand or two. They have Colorado a little bit of an edge.
One on Dallas and two on Minnesota.
Yeah, they have a little bit of an edge. This is so good.
Pacific, Vegas, Edmonton, LA, all between 100 and 104 points. That one's tight. Seattle looks like they're locked into wild card one. And like
also
you said,
an easy schedule down the stretch, by the way. They don't play anybody tough.
And they're five up on Winnipeg and Calgary, so they should be fine.
Yeah, with three games to go, they're set. But they have no one that's going to beat them. They could end up over 100 points even as the seven seed.
And the only other thing I wanted to mention – Boston won again tonight. That's their 61st win. The other night, they became only the fourth team in NHL history to have 60 wins. The record is 62. This also gives them 127 points. The record is 132 by the 76-77 Canadiens. So right now, they are on pace with four games left to break those records if they want to go for it.
When I look at that record, I always look at the wins. I can't go by the points because they change the points. Once they started giving all the points for shootout wins and all that stuff, they changed the whole point system. But the wins is just the fact that they have 61 wins is just unbelievable right now.
This is the most dominant team that I've seen in my hockey watching lifetime. And I thought those Edmonton teams were dominant, but this team against good competition every night. I mean, they find a way. I mean, those Edmonton teams were ridiculous. At the same time, they were in Edmonton, so I didn't see them as much as I'm able to catch Boston. McDavid is amazing. You know, Dreisaitl's great. Hyman is great. And, you know, on those Edmonton teams, which are really good in scoring points, but Boston has, like, complete team with offense. I mean, you know, Pastrnak as a 54 or 55. I mean, he's only six goals behind McDavid. I mean, you sit there, we talk about McDavid and he's six or seven goals behind him. I'm not saying it's that close. He's not going to catch him, but man, no one's talking about it. Cause all we talk about are those guys in Edmonton about being super and special, but these defensemen have been there forever. Guys like Carlo and stuff like that, just knocking people around. This is just a complete team. They don't seem like they have, they just seem like a team, actually. That's the thing that's most exciting about watching Boston. They have great players, but it's a team that's been kind of formed for a while and have done a great job keeping it together.
And with Ullmark and Swayman, but especially Ullmark, he's got 1.9 goals against average and a save percentage of .937. Incredible.
Yeah. We used to sit there and get excited when a goalie had a .915. Now he's sitting there at 937. He's making Sorokin look like he sucks, and he's making Gustafsson look like he sucks. Gustafsson's at 932. And you're like, he's horrible. You know, I mean, it's just that's how good this Boston team is. Just amazing.
Do we even need to do a top five this close to the playoffs? I mean, six teams in the East are clinched. 6 and basically Seattle right on the cusp of clinching in the West. Those are 13 of the 16 teams. We're getting really close to knowing everybody that's going in.
Yeah, the only point I'll make about it, G, is that the West has gotten better as the season's gone on. In the beginning, we were all very East heavy, and not because we have an East bias, because those teams were better. But teams like Colorado, Minnesota, you know, Vegas, the Kings, these teams, you know, we were on Edmonton all year just because of the offense, but these teams have gotten so much better over the last month of the season that now there's no real bias that the East is so much superior to the West. We're going to get good playoff hockey on both sides.
Yeah. Jeff? My top seven, I have four Eastern and three Western.
Yeah. Which is a lot different. I have the same.
Which is a lot different than earlier in the year when we had the top five, six, maybe top seven were all Eastern Conference.
We would look for a Western team. We would look for it, you know?
Okay. All right. Darren, you wanted to talk a little Frozen Four?
Well, just because it was an interesting thing that happened tonight. Minnesota and Boston returned to play each other in the Frozen Four. Now, again, we were awfully young when the brawl of 1976 with Herb Brooks's Minnesota Golden Gophers and Jack Parker's Boston Terriers got into a brawl 70 seconds into a game in the Frozen Four. Now, it just so happened that this was the second game of the doubleheader. By rule, it was a bench-clearing brawl. There was a spitting incident. Everybody claims who spit on who, the whole thing. And you saw a little bit of it play out in the movie Miracle, you know, if you caught any of that, about the battle. And there was a war of words between Jack Parker and Herb Brooks, and he called Brooks a thug and the whole thing. And his players didn't play cheap. Minnesota won that game tonight, 6-2. But the thing about it that was interesting is these two teams have had a storied history. They went into this. They played 26 times previously. It was 12-12-2 going into tonight. Minnesota was the top seed, and they did find a way to win it. But it was just, to me, kind of a story of the historic bench-clearing brawl 70 seconds into a hockey Final Four, Frozen Four. Back then, they just called it the semifinal. They didn't have a Frozen Four name for it, where by rule, almost every player should have been thrown out. But because it was the second game of the double, if it was the first game of the doubleheader, they would have thrown everybody out, and the winner of the second game would have won the championship. But because the first game was already played, they let everybody stay, and they gave two guys, they threw out two guys, the two instigators, the two captains. So just thought it was an interesting point. The winner of that is right now with, I believe the last I saw it, Quinnipiac was up on Michigan. So the winner of that matchup will play the Golden Gophers for the championship. That's all I had.
Okay. Kev, want to move on to the NBA? Again, NHL really close to the end. NBA really close to the end. Here we go. We're getting ready for the playoff push again. What do you got, Kev?
About two, three games left for everybody after tonight. What I thought was interesting the last week, that the top of the Eastern Conference. Last Thursday, Boston goes to Milwaukee, destroys them 140-99. Just an impressive outing. And Milwaukee had Giannis playing. It's not like anybody was sitting out here. Then you go to the second. Milwaukee at home beats Philly 117-104. Then you go to Tuesday night, and Boston goes into Philly and loses 103-101 and beat with 52. So they took turns beating each other up this week. If this is an indication of what the playoffs could be, it's going to be pretty fun. As it turns out, Boston, I think, head-to-head, they are 2-1 against Milwaukee. Two blowout wins, and the only loss was in overtime when they played without most of their starters. So possible edge to Boston that way. They know they can beat Milwaukee. Boston also leads 3-1 in Philly for the season series. Milwaukee and Philly tied 2-2. So just something to keep in mind when the playoffs come. Out west, Denver clinched the conference, but they've lost three of the last four. Their lead was down to 2.5. They've clinched it, but that race has tightened up quite a bit. What you're left with for races in the Eastern Conference, top five are settled. 8, 9, and 10 are settled. The only thing left was Brooklyn and Miami for 6 and 7. Miami beat Philly tonight, which gives
blew
them
them out.
What, 1 by 28, I think.
Yeah, they blew them out. It wasn't even a game.
Yeah, and again, Embiid played, Harden played, so it wasn't a rest game for the Philly. So big win for Miami there. Out west, looks like 5 through 9 still have to determine the order. You've got Golden State, the Clippers, the Lakers, New Orleans, Minnesota. Big thing there is, of course, being in the top six. 10 through 12, you got Oklahoma City, Dallas, Utah. I think Utah's probably fallen off enough. So it's really OKC and Dallas. They're tied. OKC has the tiebreaker for the 10th seed. For those who are not familiar, playing the way it works, 7 plays 8. Winner of that game is a 7 seed. 9 plays 10. Loser is out. The loser of 7-8, winner of 9-10 play. The winner is the 8 seed. So if you finish at if you gotta be in the play, you at least want to be 7 or 8 so that you give yourself 2 chances to at least make the main playoffs.
Yep.
That's about all I had.
Just a quick point on it. Because of this and the way it works, the top teams will play out most of the season because they're going to get almost a full week off when the season ends. So now you don't want to rest your players for 2 weeks unless you're injured. So you'll probably see guys like Embiid and Harden and guys like Tatum playing even when you would normally think that they would be, you know, resting at the end of a season because of the way this tournament works. I actually think the way they do it is the fairest way to do it. But yeah, Kev.
Yeah, you're talking about resting guys. give me the MVP race. I'm looking at the guys who are for the MVP race.
Yep.
These guys don't need any more rest. Well. Embiid, 65 games. Doncic, 65 games. Giannis, 63 games. Jokic, 68. Tatum's got 73. It seems like he plays a lot more than anybody else.
You're right.
These guys are sitting out 10 or more games this year, and they're in the league for the MVP race. What happened to our? What happened to the league where, and we've said it for weeks now, what happened to the guys there? They played 80, 81, 82 games.
They never wanted to sit out back then, Kev. They didn't. They wanted to play.
Yeah.
It's a different animal now. The game is, let's be honest, the NBA is much more of a me league than every other one of the sports that we watch. Even though it's a team sport, you know, it's very superstar oriented. The players control the league more than the owners or the fans or anything else. And it's obvious by the fact that fans miss out on somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of the games that they'll go to. They will not see the best player playing.
Yep.
That's a big number. I mean, listen, I used to remember as a kid going to a baseball game, like, and you didn't understand the Friday night, Saturday, and you go and it's Saturday afternoon game, and you go to a game, and you're like, oh, this guy's not playing today. Oh, man, it'd be so disappointing not to see one of those guys you wanted to play, you wanted to watch, or if you didn't have the pitching matchup you wanted, you get bummed out. But, I mean, but for the most part, you saw your guys playing. And yep. and the NBA was kind of similar with that. But now we sit here and it's, you know, these guys don't want to play tonight, so they're not going to. They're tired. They need rest. I blame Popovich for this whole freaking thing. Pain in the ass. Popovich ruined the game for the fan. And listen, he's a Hall of Fame coach. I'm not questioning what he's done. But he ruined the game for the fan and made it, like everything else in this country, made it into a business and not something fun. And that's unfortunately where we sit now. This is the way sports are being played. Hockey doesn't do that yet. You know, NFL certainly doesn't do that. It's only 16, 17, 18, whatever it is, 17 games. But we certainly see it in the NBA on a regular basis.
Yep.
Okay. Definitely more NBA playoff talk next week as we get really close to the end of the season. Let me hit on a couple of baseball points. Metricol Alvarez, because Narvaez is out 8 weeks now. So we're gonna see the kid up here, see how he does. Yankees have an injury to Donaldson. It's probably just 2 or 3 weeks. Hamstring tightness. Looks like LeMahieu will get some time probably at third base. Maybe a little.
That makes you excited.
Maybe a little IKF action at third. You know, he was runner-up for a gold glove a couple of years ago, IKF, by the way.
The gold glove's a sham.
Just a couple of information pieces which I thought you would enjoy based on the new rule changes. Average length of a game right now is at 238. It's the quickest games that we've had since the 80s. Batting average, 6 days in, I know, with the shift. This basically is all because of the shift. Batting averages have gone from 250 this year. Last year they were at 231. And the all-powerful BABIP stat, which is batting average of balls in play, last year at this point was at 279. Now it's at 297. So it's definitely up. And
so you're telling me this is all because of the shift?
And
I think BABIP plays a lot more into the shift.
Absolutely. And home runs are basically flat. There's only been 9 more home runs this year than last year. So you wanted more base hits and not home runs. That's exactly what you're getting at this point. Here's the only issue, and we started talking about it last week for a little bit. The stolen bases are just crazy right now. Last year at this time, there were 61 stolen bases. This year, there are 101 stolen bases. Now, the success rate has only gone from 75% to 83%. The difference is there's been 40 more stolen bases from last year. So I do think something with the pickoff rules could change at some point. Probably not this year. They probably won't do any changes to rules during the year. But I do see some change happening with that next year. Darren?
Yeah, I can't wait till the playoffs when people are able to steal because the guy looked the guy threw two balls over the first base because the guy had a lead. I can't wait till you have to pick him off or he gets to second base automatically. It's a joke, this base. I don't know. I just hate the way the pickoff works. Also, listen, I understand what you're saying with the BABIP, and I'm sure it's got some accuracy to it, Gino. But at the same point in time, they're not tracking where those hits are. They're not doing any of that crap. They're just simply giving you batting averages of players, of balls put in play. They're not saying where they're putting them. They're not saying that they're pulling them and they're going that way. So we really don't know. We're doing it all off an estimation. They're not saying the guys that pull it. They're not saying guys that go the other way. We don't know. It's 2 weeks in. For us to go over stats 2 weeks in, that's ridiculous. It's not there yet. You got to wait. Give me 2 months, I'll give it to you. But 2 weeks, no, I'm not going to give it to you. Not even 2 weeks. It's 1 week.
Do you not think the batting average being 250 this year and last year was 231 makes a point?
I don't know. I really don't. It's 1 week in.
Okay.
But you know, you played 7 games, Jay. 7.
If I can get them, I'll give you these stats all along the way.
Listen, if you have the stats in 2 months and it's showing out, great. But again, I don't know if there's been a change to the baseball. I don't know if there's been any changes to anything. None of us know.
And again,
I know that you want to defend the fact that I don't know. I think you should be able to defend whatever you want to defend. I don't understand why baseball is making this sport for fantasy people and not for people that love baseball.
I still love the new pace of the game.
Kev? Break the tie, Kev.
I'm agreeing with Darren and everything here.
Okay. It's my opinion. There's nothing to break a tie about.
Just about the fact that you're wrong. That's all. It's
you
not
know
bad.
Where a guy's going to hit the ball. You should be able to play defense where the guy's going to hit the ball more than likely.
The game is so much more watchable now. It's not even funny.
It's always been watchable.
No, it's not. It hasn't been.
Yes, it has.
Did you watch the Yankee Giants second game of the season? Did you watch the game when neither pitcher could throw strikes? Did you watch that game?
I'm not sure.
The game is watchable when the pitching is good and the hitting is good and the fielding is good. It's never going to be watchable no matter how fast it is if guys can't throw strikes and pitchers go 4 1/3. It's never going to be. It's going to be about the quality of the game. I understand pace, and I'm fine with it, that it gets a little bit quicker, but this was a timeless game that they've decided to put a time limit on. That's asinine.
I disagree.
I know you do, but I get why. You have no attention span. I get it.
It has nothing to do with that, Darren. The time of these games just became ridiculous. Everybody stepping out, everybody taking a minute and a half between pitches just became too much.
I agree with you on that.
It got to a point where you couldn't watch the game. And that was me. The guy who loves baseball couldn't sit there and watch it because it was just ridiculous. I don't want one batter to take 8 minutes. And that's what was happening.
I disagree with that. I honestly don't. I do think you're right on that.
Okay. I don't love the pickoff. I'm sorry, Kev. I don't like the pickoff rules. I think they tried to get stolen bases back into the game, and now they've done it the complete opposite direction where they basically left the pitcher helpless out there half the time now.
And I think the 15 and 20 are too short.
Okay.
I agree with you on that.
If you want to give me a little bit more time, I think five seconds would be
a long way, actually.
I'm seeing these pitchers that when they're in a jam in the fifth inning, as they're starting to tire and they're being asked to speed up because of some arbitrary number that says you've got 20 seconds to throw the ball. You know, when they need to take a little break to take the 30 seconds instead of 20.
Okay.
Gather yourself. I mean, it's just these little things that.
Well, do you not think that tweaks to these rules are going to happen at the end of the year for next year? I do. I do already.
But playoff games are going to be decided by these rules this year. Do you get upset about games that are long in the playoffs? I don't, actually. I get upset about regular season games. I'll grant you that. I don't get upset about good baseball games that go long in the playoffs. I never have.
I just want you to make sure that you're differentiating the difference between what you're saying. Because the length of a game has not been my problem. It's the wasted time between pitches has been my problem. I could sit there and watch a good 4-hour game the same way I could sit there and watch a good 2.5-hour game. But what I don't want is what was happening last year, which was one batter being up at bat was taking 8 minutes.
I get it, but the drama of a game in October does not bother me.
Well, it bothered me. I can tell you right now.
It didn't bother me at all because when your team's involved and you're waiting for a pitch and there's step offs and stuff like that, the drama just builds more.
Yeah, to me, it just does. Okay, I disagree. That's your opinion.
I never get mad about playoff baseball. But now a game is going to be decided because they can't go to the mound or the pitcher can't throw to first base or they're going to call ball four because I can't get this pitch off and we're not on the same page and someone's going to lose a game over a rule that is probably just a little too stringent.
Okay. My response is going to be, okay, that's the rules for this year.
Or Manny Machado or Tim Anderson is going to get thrown out of the game because they don't get time because they called it with 7 instead of 8 on the pitch clock.
It's the rule. The rules are the rules. What are you going to do? When we get to the NFL, I don't see anybody crying that he went past that they called the penalty because they couldn't hike the ball in the verified time.
These guys have played with that rule forever. This is a brand new rule for guys. Have to learn on the fly, G.
But how did they get there, Darren?
They've had those rules in place. Every player that plays has gotten those rules in place. But used to be when they actually started this stuff, G, that the quarterback called his own plays at the line of scrimmage. Very different. You didn't have to wait for calls to get come in. It was very different at that time.
I know,
but it's actually more advantageous. It actually goes against your argument a little bit.
But my point is at some point they changed the rule and everybody had to adapt. And they didn't adapt well that first year, okay. And then they started to adapt. And that's the same thing with every other rule change we've seen in any sport.
Some of these rules, though, are a little too much.
I think we need more offensive football next year. So I think we're going to put in a rule that says if you play a base 3-4 defense, you must stay in that base 3-4 defense the entire game. There's no shifting allowed. How ridiculous does that sound?
You're comparing apples and oranges.
How is it?
How is that apples and oranges?
Yes, it's apples and oranges. Apples. It's apples and oranges.
No, if a defensive team can't adjust to an offensive team, it's apples to apples, bud.
Yep.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
How is it not?
Listen, do you think the NFL hasn't changed the rules to make offense better?
Of course they have.
Over the years?
More.
Do you not think they've changed the rules in the NFL so that the quarterback is so much more protected than he used to be because they want more offense? So it's happened in other sports.
But what I'm saying is they have not told the defense how many defensive backs are allowed on the field. They haven't told the defense that you can't sit there and cover this side of the field. They haven't done that.
They've basically taken the fact away that the defensive backs basically can't touch the receivers.
So now basically what we're saying is that a ground ball to second base is a base hit, and we should all be excited about it. I get it.
Okay. Well, I like it. So I guess I'm okay with it.
Ground balls a second that I got to get through. Okay.
Okay. I feel like that's baseball.
The drama of October baseball is about the moments, is about making sure the pitch is right and the hitting is right. When we have a baseball game where the pitching is not as good as the hitting, the game is not as good to me. Baseball is great when good pitching and good hitting meet each other. And we're going to sit there and weaken the pitching with these rules.
Okay.
One side. We're only weakening one side.
I disagree.
You just read me the numbers, Dave. You're the one standing by the numbers. The hitting is up.
Disagree.
The averages are up. The homers are up. I know not enough for you, but they're still up.
The homers aren't up.
You're excited about the offensive numbers. So I tell you that, and then you come back and say, I disagree.
The home runs are flat.
How is 9 flat?
Darren,
flat. 9 is up.
You wanted more base hits and less home runs. And you're getting close to having that.
Well, I'm not getting less home runs. I got more.
Well, you're getting close. It's not like home runs went up 40.
No, listen, we'll see how the season goes. It's also April. Okay. Ball doesn't travel as well.
Okay.
Ball does not travel as well in the cold weather. You know that.
Okay.
I'm just saying, in my opinion, we are weakening pitching in the game.
Well, I think the rules were not put in play to weaken the pitchers. I think the rules were put in play so that they were making the playing field a hell of a lot more even, so that way you had more base hits and less and not all these home runs and not all these two outcome at bats, which was a home run or a strikeout. We'll see how it plays out.
I have a hunch home runs are going to continue to be up. That's just my take.
Okay.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Kev, any other thoughts on this one?
No.
I don't blame you.
This is the same argument we've had on the other podcast.
It doesn't go away just because Gino, what you like in the game is different than I like. It doesn't mean that I'm right and you're wrong or you're right and I'm wrong. Same with Kev.
I agree.
We all have different ways that we enjoy the game. It's not meant to be nasty. It's just, I like the idea of speed. If we could speed up the game naturally, I'm all for it. Really am. And
well,
you know,
but we saw that wasn't going to happen because it was just getting worse and worse and worse. So they had to put rules in play to do it.
I just think they made a couple of them that were unnecessary.
Yep. And you may be right. And maybe some of these rules need to get tweaked for next year. I could see the pitch clock going up by 10 seconds. I could see the pickoff rules being altered. I could see that already.
I mean, how much does it – I just don't understand why it was so important to not allow you to hold a runner on base.
Yeah, I just don't get it. I was not completely in favor of that. That was the one I wasn't completely in favor of. But, I mean, they wanted more stolen bases. That was the gist of why they put that rule in play, and they're getting it. I'm not sure we agree with it. But
no, I get it. Listen, one last baseball point. Last week when we did our overs and unders, I picked Tampa to be an under, and of course they're the last team undefeated in the major league. So I'm all over it.
We also both picked Scherzer.
but do you see who Tampa's beaten?
I know they haven't played anybody good, but they're still putting up the 5-6 runs every night, like we talked about. You don't send that number exactly. They score 16. I don't know how.
Yep.
They still do it.
For anybody who doesn't know, they sweat Detroit and Washington.
I know they be bad teams.
Two of the bottom five teams in the league.
You know.
Yep.
And then the Mets with their $350 million payroll or whatever it is, didn't score a run for two games. The Yankees, if it wasn't for Gerrit Cole, looked like they're kind of lost on the mound. Well, Cortes had a good start. I can't say that. But it's way too early to get worried about either the Mets or the Yankees. Both teams will be fine. But it is scary watching the team struggle a little bit here and there. Kev?
I think the biggest worry for the Mets fan was hearing about Brett Beatty. Luckily, it looks like it's just inflammation, no structural damage in there. He's hitting Mauricio and Vientos hit more home runs tonight. How much longer can they go with Escobar? I mean, if you notice the last couple of games, Guillorme's getting more and more time at third.
And the beauty of it is Guillorme can still get time at third as a backup to Beatty if you feel like you need a defensive substitution. Once his finger's healthy, let him get maybe another couple of weeks of swinging. You already brought up the kid tonight. You might as well bring him up too. If you were to give me the choice, I would have thought Beatty would have been the first one up. But by necessity, it goes the other way.
Yeah.
You know,
that was the only way Alvarez would be up was because of an injury.
He's a kid. You know, the Yankees, now we're going to get to see what they do at third base here a little bit. We'll see a little bit more LeMahieu, which you talked about specifically last week in the baseball preview about how you don't want to see LeMahieu play third because he's below average, and here we are. We don't have a choice. Well, we do have a choice, but it's not a good choice. We can bring Peraza up. I mean, you can move people around. IKF could play. I mean, you know.
No, listen, any of those options is still not the options that I want. I mean, my issue with LeMahieu is I just still don't think he's the right fit for this team where he's going to back up first and third. And Donaldson gets injured. He's going to be out 2 or 3 weeks. And the majority of that playing time is going to LeMahieu. Again, here we go. You know, the value of LeMahieu is not as a third baseman. I've said it a couple of times. The value of LeMahieu is a second baseman.
The funniest thing about it is, G, if LeMahieu starts hitting like he did like 3 or 4 years ago, we're all going to sit there and say, oh, hey, LeMahieu. But even though I feel the same way you do. Let him bat the leadoff spot. He's the best.
Listen, that's fine. But you know, like I said, we haven't seen that player in a while now. You know what I mean?
You're 100% right. It's going to be interesting to see if he can do it.
That batting average and on-base percentage guy that we saw 4 and 5 years ago. If we see him, it could change my argument. Probably won't because I still really don't want him at third. But anyway.
No, right. Listen, I mean, Donaldson's the guy. I mean, you know, this is where we are now until at least the trade deadline if we're not happy with him. And that's that. Kev, any other points on baseball?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Gee?
Anywhere else you guys want to go?
I think we covered everything I have. You guys?
I just have one shout out in case he's still listening an hour and 12 minutes in. Thanks for listening to our podcast. Lane on our baseball podcast, he reached out to me as a Braves fan, very happy that me as a Mets fan picked the Braves to win the division. So